Okay, great. We're moving on to the next sugya here, which is going to be dealing with timing. It's going to be dealing with questions of when we can start and end various judicial proceedings. So we're, again, moving through these statements in the Mishnah of Dine Mamonot have this rule, Dine Nefashot have that rule. Civil law, one rule. Criminal law, another. Capital cases, another. And one of those lines, one of the next lines is, back in the Mishnah, Dine Mamonot Danin Bayom Vegomrim Balaila Dine Nefashot Danin Bayom Vegomrim Bayom. So Dine Mamonot have to be begun in the day, in the daylight hours, but they can be finished at night. Whereas Dine Nefashot need to be begun in the day and completed during the day. And we're going to get into some questions about how exactly this comes out of various verses. So we'll go back to that in 1 second. I want to call your attention to the document that I put in there. And if you head to the end of it, I want to look at a couple background verses here, which are important for us understanding what's going to happen in our discussion. So there are a number of places in the Torah where some kind of designation of time, or at least the potential designation of time, can be found surrounding various procedures, and in particular, din, in particular, the question of law and sort of procedure in one way or another. Okay. One of the famous places where we get the beginning of some vision of what a legal system is supposed to look like under the Torah comes up in Parshat Yitro, and where Moshe's father-in-law is giving him all kinds of suggestions of how this is going to be a sustainable system. And one of the things he says to him is, you know, appoint all these different people. And then it says, Vishaftu et ha'am bechol eit. Okay? Judge the people at all times. Now, again, in the plain sense here, the idea seems to be they'll be available broadly. Their schedule will be available and devoted to judging cases. So you won't have to be overwhelmed. And therefore, v'ayakol adavar gadol yaviu elecha v'chol adavar katon yishbetuhem v'akel me'alecha v'nasu itach. You know, they'll take, you'll only be left with the big cases. And they'll take everything lower on the docket. And indeed, we're told that then Moshe set it up that there were all these other appointed judges beyond himself. And the result was, v'shaftu et ha'am v'chol eit. They judged the people at all times. So you can imagine if you were looking to either, you know, derive or more likely, as I think we'll see, provide support for a rule that perhaps you already knew, which is that civil cases, the kinds of things that they seem to be dealing with in this passage, like arguments between people, can happen at any time, right? That might be helpful for thinking about day versus night. A few other scattered sources, we'll see how they're pulled together. In Dvarim Kaf Aleph, in the context of a law of a favored and disfavored wife, and the case where the perhaps the husband wants to favor the younger child of the favored wife over the Bechor, the firstborn of the disfavored wife, the Torah says you're not allowed to do that. And the Bechorah must go to the eldest child. But when describing the process of granting inheritance, it says, V'aya biyom hanchilo et banav. Now, in a very plain way, that seems to just be like at the time, right? On the date, etc., when it happens. But as we've pointed out in a number of midrashim along the way, there's a real kind of sensitivity to the way language is used in different places in the Torah. And we do have that same verb in another place, hanchilo, without yom, behanchel elyon goyim. It's not beyom hanchel elyon goyim, talking about God distributing parcels of land to all the nations of the earth, such that you could hear more meaning in the word yom. Maybe there's something about the daytime as opposed to the nighttime that's important for that kind of process. Okay, just continuing our tour here, you'll see how this will all come in. In Vayikra Yud Gimel, in talking about Sara'at, the function of a Kohen to evaluate a person's body and determine whether it has the kind of disease that's going to trigger some kind of purity ritual and process, it says, V'im paroch tifrachat sarat ba'or v'chistat sarat eit kol or hanega. If the person has a certain kind of condition where the white scale disease of tzarat covers their entire skin, meroshove adraglav, and then it says, lechol mar'ei enei ha-kohen. You'll see how that's a phrase that'll become important later. For everything that the eyes of the Kohen see. Then if the Kohen sees that, he declares the person pure, because if it spreads to his whole body, actually in this case, he is pure. And then again, uveyom heira'ot bo basar chayitma. But on the day when some healthy skin reappears, he is declared to be impure. So there too is the day, as opposed to night, important. Now, the question of whether the rules for tzarat have anything to do with the rules for judgment is going to get anchored in this verse that I want to make sure we're aware of and the potential ways we might read it. In Dvarim, where it's talking actually about the mitzvah of Egla Rufa, which is a case where you have a body that's discovered and you don't know who killed it, and the town that's closest to it has to take some responsibility for it, we're told that the people who are supposed to be in the lead on part of this process are HaKohanim B'nei Levi. Okay, the Kohanim of the tribe of Levi are supposed to play a pivotal role here. Why? Kivam b'char Hashem Elokecha l'shorto l'varech b'shem Hashem. They've been chosen for special roles. And moreover, ve'al pihem yihyeh kol riv v'chol naga. And based on what they say shall be decided every riv and every nega. Now, there's two ways of reading the word nega. Riv is a fight, seems to be a civil dispute. Nega could be read the way Ibn Ezra seems to read it here, which is al pihem yihyeh onesh kol riv v'chol nega. The punishment for any fight or nega, where nega seems to be an injury that one person caused to another. That is to say, riv here would then be basically damages, cases, sort of, you know, monetary damages, and nega would be a tort. All right, that's one way of reading it. Nega just means adjudicating a dispute that's about sort of bodily injury. But nega, of course, carries the same connotation. It has is the same word that's used back up here in the Tzara'at passage we just saw, where we talk about a nega covering the body. That is to say, some kind of disease. And therefore, you could translate, based on what they say, you will decide all monetary disputes and all issues of tzara'at, of scale disease. And in fact, Targum Unculus, which is very early, right? We're talking early second century from the time of the Tanaim, translates this as Ve'al me'mereihon yihyeh kol din, based on what they say will be every judgment in a civil case, V'chol machtash sigiru. And machtash here is nega, is how you say a disease. And sigiru here is the key that what we're talking about here is hasgara, which is the Kohen's prerogative and responsibility to decide when someone with tzarat should be quarantined. All right, so that shows you there's a very old reading that nega there is a different area of law than Reev. And based on that, an early Tanaitic Midrash, which we'll see a version of in our Sugya, says the following, Sifrei Dvarim. Ve'al piyem yihyeh kol riv v'chol naga. Makish rivim l'negaim. From the fact that these are juxtaposed in the verse, we learn that rivim, civil procedure, basically, court procedure, is compared here to the procedure of tzara'at, of diseases. How so? Ma nega'im bayo, af rivim bayo. Just as you only decide nigaim during the day, can only be seen in the day. So to revim can only be taken on in the day. And nigaim can only be taken on in the day, it seems, from some of those verses that indicate the, you know, being in the vision of the Kohen, or the word bayom. And marivim shalo bikrovim af nigaim shalo bikrovim. And then we learn something in the other direction. Just as you can't have a relative decide a civil case for you, they're not valid to judge, so too you can't have a relative inspect your nega to see if it's the kind of tzara'at that requires you to be closed off, okay, to be quarantined. There's then a question here, well, wait a minute, if these two are so similar, will we extend that by saying, just as revim require three, just as civil cases require a panel of three, right? Dine mamonot v'shlosha. Do we also think that nigaim require three? Like, do you need a panel of three kohanim in order to decide whether something is tzara'at? V'dinhu, because it would be logical to say that, im mamono b'shlosha gufo lo ye b'shlosha, if in order to take someone's money away from them, you need a panel of three, in order to take away basically someone's status of bodily purity, wouldn't you need a panel of three? No. Talmud Lomar, in the context of Nigaim, it says, v'huvai la'arona kohen, o el achad mibanav hakohanim. You bring this person to Aaron, or one of his sons. That's a special verse that tells you a single Kohen can adjudicate cases of tzara'at. All right, so what you see there is an old translation of that verse that reads nega as having to do with cases of tzara'at, and a Tana'itic tradition that therefore learns some rules from one field to the other, that is to say, from tzara'at to other kinds of cases. But with some potential carve-outs where we know they're not the same. All right, that's the background for the basic questions of timing and some of the stuff we're going to get to in terms of the issue at hand, and I'll come back to this chart later on. Okay, so here we go. We've got a little piska from the sugya. Again, for those following along in their own text, which I always recommend, and recommend if you haven't gotten one yet, pick one up. We're on Lamed Dalad Amud Bet. Okay. Dine mamonot danin bayom vigomrim balayla. You begin in the day, but you can end at night. We've got this little siman, mishpat ma'aneh mateh, which we'll come back to eventually when we have enough information to know what it's talking about. Menahane mile. Where's that from? What's the basis for this? We'll see what this is in a minute. Amar bichia bar papa. De'amar kra, v'shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit. Okay, so right there, the statement is, you judge the people at any time. So it's very clear that the menahane mile here is on, how do you know you can complete a civil case at night? Because the Torah says, b'chol eit, at any time is valid. Okay, i'hachi, but if that's right, tchilat din nami. You should be able to start a civil case at night as well. If we take Bechol Eid at full depth, you should be able to start and end a case at any time. No, 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 Kiddur Rava. You have to have a sort of modification of that statement in keeping with what Rava said elsewhere. De Rava, Rame. Rava threw together, Adam smashed two verses. K'tiv, v'shaftu et ha'am Bechol Eid, u'k'tiv, v'aya b'yom hanchilo et banav. There are two verses that allude to the timing of civil cases. The first is, judge them at all times. The second is, on the day when he causes his sons to inherit. Ha-ketzad. So how's that going to work out? One of them's right day, and one of them's all times. How are you going to sort that out? So it must be, yom litchilat din, laila ligmar din. All right, you're going to apply each of these verses to one of those contexts, and that's what's going to settle your question of both where it comes from and why you don't start din at night. Now, just jumping up here, the Tosafot asks the obvious question. This is whenever you have two verses like this, and they're like, this means that, that means that. The obvious question is, Why didn't you go the other way? Right? Why don't you say, for instance, you can start a civil case anytime, but the verdict has to be given in the day. So Tosfot try to address that. Ve'ipcha leka lemeimar. You couldn't say the opposite, right? Anytime Tosfot say that, it sort of reveals, like, of course you could have said the opposite. That's why they're bothered by this. But what's the argument? Demistama tchilat hadin ikar. The more important thing is when you start. That's the one that's likely to have more restrictions on it. Ve'od, moreover, biyom hanchilo kabalat edutu dahave kitchilat din. The case of biyom hanchilo, which, right, the word biyom is specifying something that happens in the day, hanchilo et banav is sort of, they're saying, Tosfot want to say, it's like receiving testimony. That is to say, it's when you're making the decision, taking in the information of who do you want to give the inheritance to. And that is like tchilat din, as opposed to the actual distribution. I think if you pay closer attention here, you can poke holes in both of those, right? Like the Yom HaNechilo Ad Banav could be read as when it's actually distributed, which is gmar din. And you certainly could say, I don't know, maybe gmar din is ikar, like not tchilat din. And this is a Tosfot, like a lot of things we'll see in our sugya, where I think we have to realize that in most of these cases, the rule is predating the derivation. That doesn't mean, as you've heard me argue a number of times, that the readings aren't real, that they don't actually think they're finding this in the text. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that it is not as if they are coming to this with no information whatsoever on what they know the answer is going to be. So sometimes it's fun and interesting to read Tosfot's like that, that are basically simultaneously aware this totally could have come out another way, but also committed to trying to make it as coherent as possible given the conclusion we've come to. Okay, now we go on and take a little bit, I think, of an unexpected turn. Matnitin de lo k'Rabbi Meir. Now we're going to say our Mishnah does not accord with Rabbi Meir. How so? D'tanya, because there's the following bright. Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Ma Talmud Lomar al pihem yihye kol riv v'chol naga. V'chi ma inyan rivim etzel negaim. Ela makish rivim l'negaim. Ma negaim bayom. Dichtiv uviyom heiraot bo. Afrivim bayom. Uma negaim shelo besumin. Dichtiv lechol mar'e enei hakohen. Afrivim shelo besumin. Umakish negaim lerivim. Marivim shelo bekrovim. Af negaim shelo bekrovim. Ima rivim bishlosha. Af negaim bishlosha. Vedinu mamono bishlosha. Gufo lo kol shekein. Amud lomar ve'uva el Aaron hakohen. O el achad mibanav hakohen. Halamadta she'afilu kohen echad ro'eh et hanegaim. All right, now that's mostly the text we just read a minute ago from the Sifrei Dvarim. All right, but I want us to note what's different about it. First of all, in Sifrei Dvarim, it was anonymous. Here, it's Haya Rabbi Meir Omer. Okay, it's attributed to a particular Tana. It then goes on, as it does there, and says, hey, what are Riv and Nega doing next to each other? It must be so that we can learn, compare, and learn rules from one to the other. What's the first rule thing we learn? First rule is, well, negaim have to be done in the day. How do we know that? Because it says, uveyom heiraot bo, on the day when the nega is seen. So too, we learn that rivim are bayom. But now a new thing we're also learning, and this will become very important, ma negaim shelo besumi. Negaim, cases of tzara'at, cannot be adjudicated by blind kohanim. Okay, blind kohanim cannot decide. It's not even clear if they have something they're really imagining here, maybe feeling something by touch or some other way. It's very clear by the language in Parshat Tazria and Metzora is bira'ah kohen, bira'ah kohen, bira'ah kohen, like over and over. It's very much sort of a sight-based activity. But here we have this right derivation that just as a blind person cannot adjudicate the nigaim, here they give a proof text. The chol mar'e einei ha-kohen, basically the kohen in question has to have working eyes. Af rivim shelo besumin, so too blind people cannot serve as judges. Okay, we'll come back and talk about this. I want to hear some from the lawyers in the group. I know from my wife years ago clerked on the DC Circuit Court, and Judge Tatel, who was on the court, I can't remember now if he's still on the court there, was blind. So this is something that does not apply in American law, but I don't know what the history is. And I know there's some ongoing controversy around jurors and things like that. So I'll ask in a minute to hear a little bit about that. But here we're saying, Rivim also cannot have sumin. And then we've got the derivation the other direction. We learn from Rivim to Nigaim, just as Rivim cannot be done with close relatives, so Nigaim cannot. And then, lest you compare them with respect to needing three people on a panel, even though Rivim need three people on a panel, Nigaim do not. And that's because of the specific verse, Echad mi banav hakohen. Okay, so the fact that this says Rabbi Meir allows us to potentially view it as a da'at yachid, as an individual view that perhaps is not the consensus view, okay? And we also get introduced to this notion of the blind person being invalid as a judge. Let's put that aside for a moment, okay? We're going to come back to that in a second. For right now, what's significant is Matnitin delo k'Rabbi Meir. Our Mishnah, which says that you can complete a civil case at night, does not accord with Rabbi Meir. Now, where does that come from? How do you get from this braita that Rabbi Meir thinks that you can't finish a case at night? So it's a little bit of a stretch. You got to go up here if you want to see. Here, Rashi is aware of this. Rivim up here. What does he say? Afilu gmar din mashma. When it says that Rivim bayom, Rashi says that must mean no part of the trial, of the procedure, can be at a time other than the day. Now, I'm not sure that's something we would have read into the text on its own, okay? But the sugya either wants to assume that, though I don't have a good narrative of what the agenda would be, or already has come to assume that, that actually there is a dispute, and our Mishnah does not match up with this other view, and they want to bring out a view that actually thought that for all cases, both dinei mamonot and dinei nefashot, you had to be in the daytime. Okay, we got a couple chats that came in here. Let's just see here. Great, Judge Tatel alive and judging. Okay, good, I'm glad to hear it. And yes, a comment on the dinu not being so simple because you could potentially break down the logical escalation here in that way. Okay, great. So let me hear just a little bit. You can, you know, shoot your hand up and offer thoughts, or you can chat in. Would love to hear from some of the lawyers with experience in this area. What is the deal? Jurors, blind jurors, sort of the question of whether blindness has any function or role in determining who can evaluate testimony or make decisions. Yeah, Jeffrey, go ahead.
Sorry about that. I seem to recall a judge in New York one saying that, I think it was Judge Casey, that blindness was not at all a factor, except he would not hear patent cases because in those cases it matters. So where it matters, where in most cases it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The exception, I guess, proves the rule, I guess.
Right. Interesting. That would fit at least with what has come up, I know, a bunch of times, which is we've seen sort of in a lot of these rabbinic texts, they'll sort of be like a category of someone who is disqualified, right? Like a relative, you're just disqualified, you know, this disqualified, etc. and much more times in common law and U.S. law, from what I understand, you're just evaluating the credibility of, you know, who can do what in any given case, but you're not going to have a sort of across-the-board disqualification. Okay, great. If anyone has anything else to chime in, feel free to do so. What else we got here? Yes, Eric chatted in. Demeanor of witnesses is relevant. Eric, do you want to just spell that out? I gather, I don't want to speak for it, but I gather what you mean is that evaluating the way in which, what, through facial expression or various things, something is being said?
Yes, the judge will instruct the jury that you look at everything. You include look at the witnesses, if you can, and use your the common sense that you bring from ordinary life experience to decide, is this a person that you believe or you do not believe, in that demeanor, you know, shifty eyes, sitting uncomfortably in the seat, that kind of thing, would be considered relevant. Not the strongest evidence, but something that definitely is one may consider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jed, go ahead.
Yeah, just a thought about Judge Tatel, who is, you know, a well-known appellate court judge. One of the critical differences between an appellate court in our legal system and a trial court is that in the appellate court, almost everything is based on the record below. So you would virtually never, that I can really think of, have a witness come in and testify in front of appellate judges. The judges are going through the record, transcripts, which can of course be done in Braille or by audio through a reader. So it's a famous example, Judge Tatel, but different from what would happen in a trial court, where in a bench trial, for example, where there's no jury, the judge does need to assess the credibility of witnesses. I don't know what the rule is there, but it certainly presents an interesting set of challenges.
Yeah, so it's interesting, to think about Niga'im in that way also. Niga'im is sort of the ultimate assessing of facts, right, in the most direct way, and facts that actually seem to be completely dependent on sight, right, in the sense of sort of the color and the shade of what's going on in the skin is the thing that is being adjudicated, and it's not that there's any other way to get at that evidence. So we have a verse here talking about why, you know, but on some level, if you probably just ask like a six-year-old to read Parshat Negaim and not to know anything about Midrashei Halacha, they would, you know, probably quite possibly come to the conclusion, well, I don't know, I'm not sure if someone who can't see can adjudicate that. We had an interesting thing, just maybe one more comment on this. Emily, I don't know if you want to share anything more, where a primary witness was blind and you talked through a bunch of that and what, without revealing anything about whatever secret deliberations, but like, did you get guidance in terms of how to weigh that?
No, there wasn't guidance in terms of how to weigh it. There was, as someone else said, we were, you know, told to take his demeanor into account, and we all understood that he was blind, and take that for what it's worth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is a pattern I think we've seen over and over, right? Which is sort of a much more kind of case by case, having some general principle of credibility and then just weighing it case by case, as opposed to having some rules that kind of guide you broadly. Here we're seeing that played out in terms of blindness. All right, strictly speaking, in terms of where we are, the sugya is at kind of a pause point here, where basically we've said, yeah, it's not like, the Mishnah is not like Rabbi Meir, okay? You're not going to be able to square it with Rabbi Meir, because at least the way we're reading Rabbi Meir here does not support finishing a trial at night. Okay, now we're going to continue from there into a practical case, which is going to pick up on this dimension of blindness that we started talking. Hahu samya dehava b'shivavute de Rabbi Yochanan dehava da'in dina velo amar le Rabbi Yochanan velo midi. So there was a blind man who lived in Rabbi Yochanan's neighborhood, And he used to judge cases. And Rabbi Yochanan didn't say anything about it. All right, so there's actually a lot of assumptions in that story, which is that Rabbi Yochanan, had any power to intervene. Rabbi Yochanan is supposed to intervene. What does this mean about when rabbis assume that their silence implies acquiescence and all kinds of things going on? Like, you could just be like, well, who cares? Yeah, maybe someone was doing something in Rabbi Yochanan's community that he didn't like. but there's some assumption there that if Rabbi Yochanan allowed something to go on in his community, he must have at least tacitly approved of it. Okay, so simply put, fine, right? That on its own doesn't seem to be that much of a problem. Like, Rabbi Yochanan thinks, it seems, that a blind person can serve as a judge. If you look back on the previous text as being Rabbi Meir entirely, maybe not everyone agrees with that principle. And that's why the Gemara is not going to attack him from that brayta, because that is Rabbi Meir, but is instead going to come at him from elsewhere. Yeah, should we assume the blind person's a fellow rabbi? Very hard to know. I think that's not clear. It's not clear that this person is sort of playing out an alternate assumption of halakha. Like, I think even beyond a rabbi, I think we do have to assume it is a it's a Jewish judge. That is to say, in a Beit Din type context. Not that it's somehow a Jew sitting on some Roman tribunal. Okay, but what does the Gemara say? Hechi avid hachi. How could he have done that? And why is this not really consistent with what we would expect? V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, halacha kastam mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan elsewhere says that the halacha follows the anonymous mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan says halacha kastam mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan says when you have an anonymous mishnah, it is authoritative. And here's a stam mishnah. Anyone who's valid to judge is valid to testify. But there are people who are valid to testify who are not valid to judge. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, le'atuye suma be'achat me'enav. Who is that last phrase coming to add? The last phrase is coming to add to those who are valid to testify, but not valid to judge, someone who is blind in one eye. Okay? Meaning, not only someone who is blind in both eyes is invalid to serve as a judge, but even someone blind in one eye is, according to this Mishnah, invalid to judge. Yesha kasher la'aid ve'en kasher ladun, explained Rabbi Yochanan, means a person blind in one eye is valid to testify, and the implication seems to be a person blind in both eyes would not be valid to testify, but a person blind in one eye is valid to testify, but they are not valid to judge. And since Rabbi Yochanan explained that Mishnah that way, and that Mishnah is anonymous and undisputed, and Rabbi Yochanan adheres to the principle that anonymous, undisputed Mishnahs, Mishnayot, are normative, therefore we can conclude that Rabbi Yochanan must hold that blind people are invalid to judge. Okay? And therefore, how could he have tolerated this? All right. So, we're going to solve that problem. Stama achrita ashkach. Rabbi Yochanan, stama achrita ashkach. Rabbi Yochanan found another anonymous Mishnah, which had a different view. And what was that? That was, dine mamonot danin bayom vigomrim balayla. Our Mishnah, which says that you start dine mamonot in the day, but you must finish them at night, allowed him to overpower that other Mishnah. Okay, how does that work? Well, let's go to Rashi. Latuye suma be'echad me'enav. V'Rabbi Meir here, he, demakish rivim l'nigaim. So, first of all, Rashi is jumping in and being clear that the only way we can really make this sort of fully hold together is we have to assume that rivim are like nigaim, because only by comparing rivim to nigaim are we going to get the prohibition on blind people judging? Because the origin on a blind person adjudicating something actually comes from Tzarat. It comes from the case of Nega. So, okay, we have to assume that Rabbi Yochanan is playing according to Rabbi Meir's rule in order to make this work out. But now the key, Stama Achrita Ashka, he found another text which implies that blind people are valid to judge. So stama achrita ashkach machsher sumin, that another text that validates blind people. How? Because this text allows completing a monetary case at night, which is dumya de suma, which is the same as being blind. That is to say, the case is being adjudicated at night. You can't see. Nonetheless, you're allowed to try the case. It must be, therefore, that seeing is not so important in order to go through the process. Okay? Now, we'll come back to what's going on here. That makes sense, but that's the argument right now. Okay? Rabbi Yochanan, you would think, should have invalidated blind people from the Mishnah in Nida, which is Stam Mishnah, and which he explicated as forbidding blind people from ruling, but he's got this Mishnah which allows Gomrim Balayla. Now we're going to ask, my Olmeid Dehai Stama Mehai Stama. Well, very nice, but like, what makes that Stam Mishnah better than this Stam Mishnah? I understand you found one of equal weight, but what makes it of greater weight such that you allowed this person to judge in your neighborhood? Two possibilities. Iba it ema stama de rabim adif, the iba it ema mishum de katane la gabe hilchata de dina. Okay, so these are actually both very interesting. One possibility is a stama that follows a majority opinion is better. Okay, let's look at this. Stama de rabim adif. Dehahi Rabbi Meir. Because as Rashi was very careful to point out earlier, actually, the other Mishnah in Nida that talks about a blind person being invalid to judge assumes that you are deriving laws about civil cases from Tzara'at, and that is specifically Rabbi Meir's view. Hahi Rabbi Meir here, which is to say, to put another way, the coherence of the Mishnah in Nida as read by Rabbi Yochanan depends on making Rabbi Meir's exegetical move from Negaim to Rivim. Whereas, right, the other Mishnah is just general. It doesn't depend on anyone saying anything like that, okay? And so what does Rashi say here? Again, Stama de Rabbi Madif de Ahi Rabbi Meir here, v'chivan de beduchta achriti hadar Rabbi v'satam kerabanan avdina kavate. And since in another place, Rabbi, that is to say Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, as the editor of the Mishnah, went back and taught an anonymous view in keeping with his opponents, so we follow that other Mishnah. Meaning, since Rabbi Meir has this view of you compare Negaim to Rivim, and that gives him this blanket rule of you can't even finish a case at night, but we know that the Mishnah elsewhere says that you can finish a case at night and does not ascribe that to Rabbi Meir, and you don't need to ascribe it to Rabbi Meir, that Mishnah and all of its implications are dominant. And since that Mishnah rules that you can finish a case at night, and deciding a case at night is no different than a blind person deciding a case during the day, so a blind person can be a judge. Okay, that's possibility one. Possibility two, ve'ibayit ema mishum de katane lagabe hilchata dedina. It matters the context in which a thing is taught. And here we get a great Rashi that indicates sort of some deep awareness of how the Mishnah is put together. What's the difference between Mishnah Sanhedrin, which is our Mishnah, Dina Mamonot Bayom, Laila, etc., and Mishnah Nida, which is Kol Kasher Ladun, Kasher Lehaid? Mishum de Katane La, says Rashi, Leha de Danin Balaila, Gabe Hilcheta de Dina. this particular point that you can judge at night is taught in the context of a whole slew of halachot about how you adjudicate a case. Hacha b'Sanhedrin, Tanya Rabbi gabe dine mamonot. And this version of the Mishnah where you say you can judge at night, Rabbi, again, as redactor of the Mishnah, taught it in the context of dine mamonot, of the broader rules of civil procedure. Shma mina ikar hi lemeilaf mina. You learn from that context that this is the real Mishnah that's controlling and that's important. De'ilu hahi de'kol ha'kasher b'malsechet nida, because that other text in Nida, which from which you can derive that a blind person can't be a judge, Tanya Rabbi Agav Grara. That was taught sort of along the way, dragged along by a whole other set of cases, in the way that the Mishnah sometimes goes off topic and teaches a whole bunch of parallel things from a whole other areas of law. D'tanya hatam ki hanei milei tuva b'perek basiman. If you go to the sixth parak of Nida, parak basiman, and you look at all the Mishnayot there, you'll see there's a ton of Mishnayot of yesh this that are not that, but there are this. That yet, you know, everyone who's X, right? It's a whole set of Mishnayot that go, all X are Y, but there are some Y that are not X. All right, it's a whole series of Mishnayot that way. Hilkach, lava liba de hilchata satam. When the Mishnah is gathering texts and saying, you know, things based on a pattern, it is not necessarily committing normatively to those texts. Ela mishum de matzrich vetane hanach de damu ahadade. It's just collecting things that are similar to each other, that are mnemonically similar to each other. Basically, the genre of the Mishnah and Sanhedrin, Rashi wants to say, is sort of normative psika. The genre of the Mishnah in Nida is anthology, in order to preserve various rabbinic traditions. And therefore, this is more normative. 100% an extremely literary read and a real kind of attentiveness to the way in which actually the Mishnah works. Great, okay, and parallel with Rambam and Yerushalmi and Bavli and trying to figure out, right, when is the Bavli really creating a sugya in a way that seems like the literary motives are primary, in a way where there might be another Yerushalmi that's sort of getting down to brass tacks. And therefore, despite the general normative preference for Bavli over Yerushalmi, you might go in that direction.
It's not quite that.
Go ahead, spell it out.
It's when the Iker Sugya. Brody says when the Sugya, the ruling is in the Sugya, let's say Zraim, and the Yerushalmi is dealing with it, while the Bavli has a ruling of Zraim in the middle of Kodshim or in the middle of Nezikin. By the way, the ruling is by the way, but not in the Iker Sugya, So then Brody says the Rambam follows the Yerushalmi. It's somewhat what you said, but...
Good, yeah. So I would say, I don't know what Brody says in that particular passage, but one of the things that scholars have pointed out with the Rambam is that they often feel that the Ikar Sugya, that notion of when is it sort of like really the sort of the essence of the matter, the Rambam in a number of places will say, oh, come on, this is just the Sugya where basically they're having a discussion. It's someone else put in here, sort of dictum versus holding may also be helpful.
That's a little different. That's like lo naniach Talmud aruch v'nifsok halacha v'matzah matan shel Talmud. Here he's saying, even if you have a ruling in the Bavli, but the ruling is not in the Ikar Sugya. They bring a rule, but they bring a rule of Zraim in the Zikin.
Gotcha.
Okay, so it's a little different.
Little different. Yeah, good. I understand. Yeah, a little different. Different dimension. Okay, great. As far as how common this is, I would say this happens to Rabbi Yochanan a number of times because they've got him on this halacha kastam mishnah statement. When they find him doing something out of keeping with a stam mishnah, they get nervous about that. Now, in reality, you know, if we were dissecting this deeper here, I think we could do a different, interesting reconstruction of what's going on here in terms of blind people and judging who thought what, and how distinctive is Rabbi Meir's position. The other thing I don't know exactly what to make of, as I pointed out, is in the Sifrei, the original Midrash Halakha that we looked at the beginning, it doesn't seem to be a specific view of Rabbi Meir, right? It seems to be just sort of a general position. But you see here, the whole sugya hinges on some level on it being Rabbi Meir, such that we can say, oh, Stama de Rabbi is different, right? If you didn't have Shaya Rabbi Meir Omer, you would not be able to make that move. And that's something, I don't know, I didn't get to check all kinds of other parallels, Yerushalmi and other places, but I wonder if something happened even in the transmission in Bavel that ended up attributing this to Rabbi Meir in some way. Okay, in any event, now I think Jerry, you had a question earlier, would Rabbi Yochanan agree with Rabbi Meir in the capital case? You want to just spell out your question?
Sure, he's basing that a Summa can't judge on our Mishnah. Our Mishnah allows a capital case at night. Doesn't allow a capital case at night.
Right, so meaning would Rabbi Meir say that a blind person can't judge a capital case?
Or the flip side with Rabbi Yochanan. Right.
Right.
Rabbi Yochanan.
Would Rabbi Yochanan agree?
The first thing by saying is weak is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. No, it seems that that's what you would have to say if you're following through the logic here. I think the question is, how much is that self-evident? Right? You know, the Tosfot here have a different, couple different problems, like on this Stama Achrina Ashkach, okay? Dine Mamonot Matrilin Bayom Vagomrim Balayla, they jump in and point out, Tema, Dil Matama De Matnitin De Hacha, Mishum dichtiv shaftu et ha'am bechol eit, aval inyan suma makshinan rivim l'nigayim. They're like, I don't understand. How can you assume that our Mishnah, right, actually allows blind people to judge? It could be that the motivation for our Mishnah to allow for judging at night is not because it thinks eyesight is irrelevant, but because there's an explicit pasuk, which we quoted at the beginning, which says, v'shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit. So there's a license for people otherwise valid to judge at night. But if you're asking about blind people, maybe they accept the limud that Rabbi Meir offers from Nega'im, which I would say is also a backhanded way of Tosfot pointing out that Rabbi Meir's position, you know, it's almost like they're intuiting that this Braita is Divrei HaKol in the Sifrei, right? Which is to say, there actually seem to be some basic comparisons here that seem to be like broad positions of consensus, or at least reasonable enough that you would not assume that you would throw out everything that Rabbi Meir said just because you're throwing out one piece of what he says. So that's where I think it's further hard to adjudicate what did Rabbi Yochanan actually think, the man. But when you get to what the sugya does with him and understands him, it would seem you'd have to come to your conclusion, right? They'd have to limit it in a case of dinei nefashot. Okay, great. Now let's fill out the rest of our sugya and get a little bit into the midrash ping pong to sort of fill out the rest of this. Because actually building off that Tosfot, we do have the claim that we have to deal with v'shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit, right? We started out our sugya by saying, why can you complete these cases at night? Because of the verse, v'shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit. Well, Rabbi Meir apparently doesn't think that you can judge cases at night. So what does he do? V'Rabbi Meir, hai v'shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit, mai darshe be. So Rabbi Meir, what does he do with that verse, v'shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit? He's got to do something with it, the presumption is. There's got to be some expansive meaning of judging them at all times. Amarava lituya yoma miunan. It's to add a cloudy day, lest you think that you can't start a court case on a cloudy day. Now, why would you think that? Ditnan, because there's a Mishnah that says, Ein ro'ina tanigayim shacharit uveina arbaim velo betoch habayit, velom beyom hamiunan, mipnei shekeha nireit aza, velo batzauraim, mipnei sheaza nireit keha. So there is a Mishnah that says you actually have very limited windows as a Kohen to view tzara'at. You can basically see tzara'at between 10 and 11 in the morning and like 2 and 3 in the afternoon. Okay, something like that. Why? You can't see them first thing in the morning or late in the afternoon, nor in a house, nor on a cloudy day. Why? Because dull white discolorations will look like bright white discolorations. That is to say, the darker it is, the more a white patch of skin will stand out. And it could be that it's too dim to qualify as tzara'at, but you will think it's bright white, and it's got to be somewhat bright white in order to qualify as tzara'at. So you can't do it at that time of day, but you also can't see them at noon. Mipnei she'alzan yireit keha, because you will then underestimate things that are actually bright white and think that they are dull white. So under the assumption that there is some relationship and connection between Nega'im and Rivim, which we know Rabbi Meir has, he might have otherwise extrapolated from the fact that, well, if the Kohen cannot sit in judgment of Tzara'at on a cloudy day, a judge cannot sit in judgment of a case on a cloudy day. And only the verse, V'shaftu et ha'am v'chol eit, gets you out of that, but it does not get you to night. V'shaftu et ha'am v'chol eit would basically mean daytime hours, no matter what's in the sky, not any hour on the clock. Okay, so, all right, that we've taken care of. If you're in the document, you can see I made up a chart here if you want to follow. I'm not going to screen share it, but I made up a chart that sort of shows you who's saying what about what. You may find it helpful to follow along. The Rabbi Meir, Hai b'yoman chilo et banav mai avid le. Rabbi Meir, okay, and what does he do with b'yoman chilo et banav? Remember at the beginning of the sugya, we had Rava saying, there's two verses, shaftu et ha'am b'chol eit, gets you finishing at night, b'yoman chilo et banav, gets you must start in the day. But Rabbi Meir does not need b'yoman chilo et banav to start in the day, he just learns it from Nega'im, from u'v'yom hera'ot bo. So what does he do with that? Hahumi bai lelich detane rabba bar chanina, kame de Rav Nachman, v'haya b'yom anchilo et banav, b'yom ata mapil nachalot, v'i ata mapil nachalot balayla. Okay, so what does he use it for? He uses it for what this braita uses it for. This braita that was quoted by Rabba bar chanina in the presence of Rav Nachman, a story we'll return to in greater depth in a moment. The drasha there, though, says, the Yom Hanchilo Ed Banav teaches you that nachalot, specifically bequests, inheritances, those kinds of things can only happen in the day and not at night. Not general law. General law we already knew from Nega'im, from Makish Rivim LeNega'im. But here we say, we learn further that inheritance cannot happen at night. Okay, so now we're going to go deeper into this story. We've tied up that loose end of what happens with Rabbi Meir's use of our two key verses. But now, Rabbi Bar Chanina teaches this in the presence of Rav Nachman, and Rav Nachman retorts, Amar le, elameata man de shachiv b'yamam yartun le b'nei, uman de shachiv le b'lelia lo yartun le b'nei? What? If someone dies at night, their kids don't inherit them? Doesn't make any. What do you mean? Inheritance can only happen in the day. Dilma din nachalot ka'amrat. Maybe what you meant was doing a law, a judgment, an enactment of nachalot, of inheritance, is what you meant. And now he's going to spell out what he means by that. Ditanya, because there is a braita that says the following. V'ayta livnei Yisrael lechukat mishpat, ora kol aparasha kula lihyot din. In the context of the story of Benot Slofchad, who come forward and demand inheritance because they have no brothers, and therefore their father's name should be wiped out, he shouldn't be left without land, the Torah gives a whole bunch of other succession rules. It is often referred to as parashat nachalot. And it ends with Ve'aita livnei Yisrael lechukat mishpat. That this principle, but understood here as these set of laws and protocols and preferences around nachala, around inheritance, shall be for Bnei Yisrael for a chukat mishpat. Now that's kind of weird, right? Normally you would say lechukat olam, which means this is not a one-off, but this is a rule that you're going to do, right? Or chukat olam adorotechem. Chukat mishpat is taken here by the Midrash with that peculiar formulation to mean to be a law that should be treated like a civil case. It's a chukah that's like a mishpat, okay? Or a kol parasha kula liyot din. The whole parasha is summarized, says the Midrash, by that phrase, to be din, to be a case of like a court case. Meaning what? Kidder Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. In the spirit of what Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav. De Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Shlosha shenich nesu levaker et achole, ratzu kotvin, ratzu osin din. Shnayim kotvin, ve'en osin din. So Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, someone is on their deathbed. If three people go in to visit that person, and that person reveals orally on their deathbed what they want done with their possessions. If there's three of them, they can decide to do one of two things. They can write down what the person about to die has said, and that will serve as a kind of edut, a kind of testimony of what they wanted. And then that document, that record of what the person said, can be brought to a court later, which can basically execute the estate. Or they can do din. They can, on the spot, decide to function as a three-person court and actually divvy up the belongings right there based on the statement of the person about to die. However, if there are two of them, all they can do is write it down and they can't do din. Meaning, two things. One, you cannot have an execution of an estate with less than three people functioning as a proper tribunal of three. But if you do have three people, you can basically convene an ad hoc court in the presence of the estate, of the person about to die, and simply execute the judgment. That's the power granted by V'hayta livnei Yisrael l'chukat mishpat, which is basically read here as, and the Torah hereby delegates to Bnei Yisrael the power of sitting in ad hoc court formations for the purposes of distributing up assets. This isn't really a will, right? This is a shriv mira indicating what he wants. And the question, more the point is, at what point can you sort of actually divvy up the belongings? Here, Rashi is helpful. I'll just pull him up here. Okay. Dilma dinei nachalot ka'amrat. This is what Rav Nachman is saying. Is this what you mean? What do we mean, dinei nachalot? Debayom havya tzava'at met din pasuk. Ve'ein sarich od ledayanin. Maybe what you mean is when someone about to die issues a tzava'ah, right? It's not really a will, but it's an oral, right? Declaration of what's going to happen. When such a thing happens in the day, that is considered pasuk. That is considered done. That is considered decided. And you do not then need to bring it to court. Okay? And going down further, when he's describing here, lihyot din, demashma hapalat nachalot din katsuvhu bishat hamita, that bequeathing something as an inheritance is just like a total execution of judgment at the moment of death. Hakol kemosha amar hamet, just what the person declares as they're dying completely counts. Ve'ena davar tzarich dayanin, you don't need a court to actually execute that oral will, as it were. If, for instance, three children go in and hear from their parent, here's how I want you to divide it, they can simply go and divide up the estate on their own based on deciding to sit there basically as judges and basically make that decision. Okay, but if they are two, they cannot do that. Relevant to our point, the Amar of Chista, Lo Shanu Ela Bayom, Aval Balaila, Kotvin Ve'eno Sin Din. But all of this only works, according to Rav Chista, in the day, because at night they cannot do din. Why? Meaning even afterwards, they can't do it. Mishum dahava lahoedim ve'ein eid na'ase dayan. Because when they gather at night, since night is not a time where you can be in a din capacity, they are actually just functioning as witnesses. And then there's a principle pops up in a number of places that a witness cannot later be a judge on the same matter that they're testifying to. So once they had to be in a capacity of a witness, they can't convert into being the tribunal that's going to enforce the, you know, distribute the estate based on the testimony. And so therefore, they cannot at night do any kind of judgment, not just at night, but even after. What would that all mean? If you follow that Braita and Rav's explanation of it practically and Rav Chista's rider on it, right? What it means is, of course, someone who dies at night, their kids inherit them. But what you can't do is execute basically an estate at night. All right? That can only happen during the day. And then the end of the sugya is Amar le'in hachika mena. He's like, yeah, that's what I meant. I was talking in shorthand, but that's what I meant all along. Okay? So where does that end us up at the end? That ends us up where basically we have accounted, again, if you're looking at that file, you see sort of how it came out. We've accounted for all the different verses matching up. In terms of Professor Kaplan, your question about the Matnat Shchiv Merah being only valid midrabanan, so that's exactly what the Tosfot say here, and they get into that problem, which is that they say v'tzarich leokume kra kishehikna the divrei Shchiv Merah lav kektuvinu chemesuri midoraita ala midrabanan. It must be that the verse they're thinking about is when there was an actual act of transfer. So it was not just something oral, but it was something that was actually either somehow transferred. It raises questions because it doesn't seem like that's the plain sense, right, of what's happening there. But you're correct to raise that concern, and that clearly is coming up for some of the Mefarshim. Can I ask again from any of the lawyers, I'm curious, anything about sort of timing, when things can begin or end? Is that too just case by case? Like if the lawyers agree to come in, the judge can call at any time. Are there any times by law, like you can't start something at night or on a federal holiday or anything like that? Would love to hear what people know about that dimension. I don't know, Judge Bartanoff, if you're here this evening, not to put you on the spot, but
I can give you, it's David, I can give you a couple of things. The real people who control when you can have hearings is the union that controls the court officers. They tell you when you can begin and when you can end.
Mm-hmm.
But that Judge Rakoff in the U.S. Bank, in the Southern District has held court outside in the park when the court officer said he couldn't do this in his courtroom anymore. He said he's continuing, he'll just have to continue this hearing outside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I can say is you can't serve subpoenas in New York on the Sabbath day. And there's a great case discussing what time does the Sabbath day begin and end according to the various shitot and who should govern.
Wow. And what are some of those shitot?
Like, I don't remember. This was a fight it was a Satmar versus somebody else fight.
But that is variable based on the religious commitments of the subpoenaed?
I don't remember. That was one of the questions. Did the legislature pick one, or did it depend on the subpoenaed or the subpoenaed? or something else.
That's fascinating. All right, we have some other comments here that not a general rule, judge deciding. Original provision said Sunday, but they read it broadly. Right, Zoom hearings now are changing all kinds of things around. Moving along for the sake of the jury's time, nothing specific. Okay, fascinating. Yeah, again, this I think is another great example. It's hard to know, you know, how much of this is based in any real-time experience, memory, record of what's going on with Bate Din, how much of it is actually playing out some value of how we think things should be done. I think it's hard not to hear, right? There's sort of the underlying value of V'shaftu Adam B'chol Eit is some version of justice delayed, justice denied. There's some aspect there of like, you got to be able to sort of plow through even as, right, Dinei Nefashot in some ways we've seen, it's like maybe justice delayed is injustice averted. and so make them sleep on it at night, make them do all kinds of things. I think there is some aspect of that. And then I think as you see in a sukkah like this, there's also just some reading the Torah, like carefully and trying to pick up on the midrashic clues in ways that sometimes I think, you know, has to be taken for what it is, which is really loving and believing in the sort of infinite meaning of the words of the Torah and wanting to get answers from that without necessarily knowing everything in advance or everything being about an independent statement of values. What I kind of like about sugyot like this is I feel like all of those are sort of meeting in the middle in some kind of way. So, all right, terrific. Next time we're going to move on to the other half of this, which is Dinei Nefashot do not happen at night. And we're in now actually for a bunch of kind of short sugyot. We're probably going to run through a whole bunch of them next time. And then there's one that's longer after that. But we'll be continuing to rack up some more details from our Mishnah. Great to learn with everyone as always. See you next week.